Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, how's it going? Welcome to the 199th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Grace Watch Media and Jeff Barahand. I am Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. 199, are you out of your mind?
I am.
Do you remember those commercials?
Yeah, is it for pizza or for
I think it's
pagers?
Like maybe like hamburgers or... I don't know.
99, are you out of your mind?
Today we've got Joe Hardesty on the podcast. He's a producer who's done a ton of awesome television shows. Dead to Me, American Vandal, seasons 1 and 2, a CBS all-access show called...
No Activity. Yeah, he's done... I mean, he does Dead to Me, which to me is all that matters. And he did American Vandal, and I think that's pretty freaking awesome
pretty
for
awesome.
A guy that was like literally a PA last time I talked to him.
Not literally. He's an old friend, but we both worked with him.
By literally, I mean figuratively.
Yeah, yeah.
199, are you out of your mind? The Denny's Grand Slam.
There we go. That's what it was. Was it the Lenny's Denny's ladies? Do you remember?
Maybe.
They'd be like, only at Lenny's.
Denny's.
Denny's.
Yeah. Yeah. But Joe Hardesty, yeah. It's a really good talk about just, you know, how he climbed his way to the top. And honestly, like... unlike most episodes where the answer is usually some form of just shoot it, I feel like his answer is a little bit more of just stick with it and be really good at your job.
Yeah.
And that is like, I know from being friends with a lot of people that hired him as a PA and then as a coordinator and then as a producer that they just always knew he was like the best person to hire. Just insanely reliable, insanely hardworking, smart.
Even tempered.
Yeah. And never like above the job.
Yeah.
And I think it's very apparent even from our interview with him.
Yeah. A real class act, that Joe Hardesty, and we're so excited about his successes. So if you want to learn more about how to become as big a big shot as Joe is, check this episode out.
Yeah. And if you would rather spend your time patronizing us, is that what it's called? Patronizing?
Patreonizing. Yeah.
Patreonizing us, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a place where you can throw a few bucks a month to us if you feel like you're getting something useful out of the podcast, and it just helps support all the great programs that we bring you here on Just Shoot It, including Just Shoot It and an occasional live show, which we're doing in March.
Just Shoot It.
March 15th, potentially.
Brought to you by listeners like you.
Okay. Anyway, let's talk.
A lot of 90s TV references for me today. A little punchy.
Sit, boo-boo, sit. Good dog. Okay, here's Joe.
Hit this with the hit list here, Joe.
We're talking.
American Vandal.
American Vandal.
Dead to Me.
Dead to Me. No Activity, which is a CBS All Access show. I did this doc for HBO called Ferrell Takes the Field. Starring the Will Ferrell.
Along with our friend Evan Kaspar.
Along with Evan Kaspar. Yeah.
I watched it because I thought it was Colin Farrell, and when it was Will Ferrell, I just turned it off.
Yeah, get that
like, what a waste of time.
My first television show that ever aired on television was a little show called Foul Ball.
I didn't know it was your first.
That was my first. Yeah.
Oh, is that what you did?
Yeah.
Matt, the CBS thing?
That I produced myself. Yeah, that was Foul Ball.
Oh, wow. That's so funny. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my first TV show.
Yeah, me too.
I was like, how did I get here? This is insane.
You also produced the hit viral video, House of Thrones.
House of Thrones. Did House of Thrones. Did a couple. We did some industrial video in Vegas.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Did you work on that Hulu show that Evan and Joe produced?
No.
Basketball one?
No, we got Next now.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't do that one. I did, though.
But College Humor, you did a bunch of stuff.
Right? Yeah, I did a bunch of College Humor stuff. I'd work with Funny or Die for a bit doing some of their longer form series and some pilots. I did a couple of independent films, one of which I think my first big thing that I produced on my own, which was this movie, which has many titles. I'm going to call it by, I think, what's on IMDb, which is Backup Boyfriend, which is my least favorite title. It was originally called Mr. Intangibles, and then it was called Bad Fan, and then a distributor called it Backup Boyfriend. And I don't know what it is on IMDb. It's one of those three. So for all of those people going to check it out on IMDb, use all three names.
But that was the movie that you wrote and
produced. That was the movie that I produced and acted in. My buddy Ben Belay wrote it and directed it. And that was back in 2012. And then after that, I did another very, you know, that was a super low budget film. I did another low budget film the next year called Let's Kill Ward's Wife, which was...
Yeah, with Scott
Foley and Patrick Wilson and Donald Faison, some other...
Somehow you got in with like Will Arnett and his people too.
Yeah, right? I got in with them just doing weird comedy industrial
College
videos.
Humor stuff was like... College Humor and Will Arnett were pretty tight there for a while.
They right, like right, with Dum Dum. Yeah, I was doing a bunch of Dum Dum stuff. Yeah.
Okay, enough credits. Yeah. We get it. All I heard
was
dead
work,
to me.
I work, guys. I work.
No, but so let's... Can we just talk about how you went from PA to producing? I think American Vandal is probably your biggest jump, right? Because you were co-EP on that? What's your...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is... Yeah, let's just...
Sure, yeah. I will be the first to admit that I caught some breaks that enabled me to maybe raise through the ranks faster than a typical producer, especially in television. But yeah, it started that fateful day or that fateful year probably when I moved to L.A.,
As an actor,
and ran out of money within a very few months, like 3 months. I started selling all the things I owned, and I started working as a PA because I had grew up around cameras. My dad shot stuff back up in Alaska where I'm from, and in college I had interned at The Daily Show and SNL. So I was familiar with, you know, the kind of the industry and things like that. So I was able to pretty seamlessly jump in and start PAing. And I met some folks that were doing low budget features and low budget comedy stuff.
Wait, did you go to film school or no?
No. I studied, I went to NYU. So it was adjacent to the film school, but no, I studied music and journalism.
Useless stuff.
Totally useless. Completely.
I mean, not super profitable. We didn't realize at the time, right? But the music industry and journalism, they're both crumbling, right? So,
well, journalism is still pretty cool.
Music, so cool.
It's a dying.
But also, like, you know, there are not as many professional journalists as there were maybe when you first started.
I had no interest in being a journalist, which is funny. I enjoy journalism because my parents were both journalists.
But you
when
thought
I was
it was
a kid.
Like about journaling?
Yeah, I thought it was more of a journaling thing. No, I liked it. I mean, I still do love journalism, and for a long time I kind of romanticized, but oh, maybe I'll transition into that at some point in the career. But I think that also that itch can be scratched with documentaries. But I kind of didn't have any intention to pursue a career in either music or journalism, which is funny that I would choose to spend so much money studying those things. But all that is to say, I was at NYU, so I was amongst a lot of film students. I was making things on my own, acting and producing and writing and all that kind of stuff in college. Moved to LA, run out of money, start being a production assistant. So I started working with a couple guys that we both know, Inman Young and Joe McAleer. They were doing low-budget films, low-budget comedies, pilots, things like that, and... What's really cool,
outside of the studio system.
They're not doing an NBC
pilot. They're doing like a YouTube pilot.
Yeah. And what I think was really cool and why I'm so grateful that I fell into that is because I think that, and I see this a lot in TV, is like if you jump in as a PA on a big TV show, you're going to be a PA for years. And then you're going to maybe get that APOC break and be an assistant production office coordinator. And then you got to be that for a couple of years before
which
you can.
Which is what you're in the office, like
you're in the office, yeah.
And coordinating then, parking and stuff like that.
Everything, POs, and a lot of minutia. And then you have a few years of that before you're able to take the step up to coordinator. And then you have a few 5-7 years of that before you can be a supervisor. And then you know it's like it. If you get in the bigger structure, that is network TV or bigger studio stuff, I do think it takes, you really have to earn your stripes. You can't just jump in, be a PA once and be like, oh, that's cool, I can do this now.
Yeah, sure.
But you're also surrounded by people who are have been doing it longer that want it also. So that I'm assuming right. you kind of have people that are kind of pushing you down a little bit.
Well, and
like
also,
telling you to get in line.
I mean, maybe not, but that kind of, I think, is an office-to-office problem. But there is so much about making a network television show. You have to be so detail-oriented that just getting good at that job takes a little while.
Yeah. No, there's so much more, and there's more at stake, and there's more volume, there's more people, there's more numbers, there's more elements. Yeah,
more episodes, even.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Versus jumping in to do a 12-day feature, you know, I could come in as an office PA and then and jump and be on, and then, you know, and then I'm the set PA, and then I'm the post PA, and then and now all of a sudden, you know, you're able to. For me, I was very hungry when I came out here, and I quickly found out that I liked what I was doing and I was good at it, and so I just very quickly was trying to progress and elevate and make the jump. So yeah, I came up doing the production office route, which was a production assistant to a coordinator to a supervisor into producing.
And do you think it was important that you kept working with the same producers, or did you try to, do you think it's important to try to work with like a bunch of different people?
I think it definitely, I think there's advantages to both. I think in my particular case, I was coming up underneath someone who was very willing to help me elevate, and still to this day, I mean, I consider him a mentor and a friend, and he's someone I still call for, you know, questions or things like that, or want to pick his brain about something. So I think that there's something that can be amazing about sticking with one person, because you can really grow under them, especially if they're helping lift you up. I also think it's really cool to see the different styles of different producers, because there's so many different ways that you can go about making a TV show or making a movie, like as far as attitude, how you structure an office, how you work with your show, you know, like there's so many different styles. So I think that it's really cool. And one thing that I probably didn't do enough, because I did, not that it was insular, but I just so happened to work with the same producing team. So I didn't get as many like producers I got to work with. But I do think like that's, I don't think there's anything wrong with either way. But back to my kind of how I got here. So yeah, I got in with this team. They were busy. The internet was a thing that was now spending money to make things.
Sure. You were like perfectly timed to have a resume to be the guy that they call. They couldn't call the person you are now, right? But they also were beginning to spend money. I remember you and I sat down a couple of years ago now, and you were like, have you heard of Go 90?
Yeah.
They're spending some money, I've heard.
Yeah, like all of a sudden, like the, you know, College Humor and these digital companies that people started to notice and give them money to make branded content. Like I did branded for like my first big producing gigs were big producing gigs. I say like I was doing like a $20,000 budget. And to me at the time, I was like, oh my God, this is so much more than you get doing like an independent film. And so, yeah, I think I came around at the right time where I had been grinding for a few years as a coordinator and a supervisor and really understanding and knowing the ropes from like a kind of small to medium budget. And then when the digital company started spending money, I was able to produce those. And now all of a sudden my producing resume started getting bigger and bigger because there was so much content being made for a digital comedy.
And when you're producing, what does that mean when you're producing something for Funny or Die? Are you hiring the director and the crew, and are you involved in the script? Are you involved in the edit? What does that mean?
It's different from show to show. I think that at a base level, I'm always serving a line producer function. So I'm doing budgets, I'm doing schedules, I'm hiring key crew, I'm interfacing with the studio or the production company. And then beyond that, kind of depends on my relationship with either the production company or the studio. The last few shows I've done, Dead to Me is a CBS Studios production that airs on Netflix. American Vandal was CBS Studios for Netflix, but also Funny or Die produced that. But so my on top of line producing, I'll work with just basically making sure that all of the heads are talking to each other and everyone's on the same page. It's really just a communication position, making sure the showrunner knows the studio's expectations on this particular thing and making sure the production company has approved this, that, you know, there's just so much. Once you get a lot of companies and people involved, like it really is a full-time job, just making sure everyone's on the same page, has the same information, knows when to expect things. So yeah, on top of just doing the day-to-day, that's a big part of the job. And then also there's a huge interpersonal HR, human-to-human part of the job. I think that's, you know, almost half of what you deal with on a day-to-day is you have people coming to you with things, whether it's, hey, I need this piece of gear tomorrow, or hey, I need an extra body, like we just can't cut it with three guys on the team, or hey, this other department head's an asshole and they're talking shit to everyone about the show. Like, so there's so much interpersonal stuff to just deal with just to make sure that the show's running smoothly. So it can be as small as tracking a budget, making sure the costs are okay, signing payroll. But I think that I pretty much always like to do as much as I can and do what's best, you know, what the show needs. And that more often than not is just being the person to talk to, like for big or small.
And so what about the creative side of things?
It really depends on, I think, my relationship with the creator. There's some shows that they have everything they need. They don't need another voice. They don't need another, you know, cook in the kitchen, and I'm just there to, you know, make sure things are running smoothly. Whereas other shows where I maybe have a different relationship with the creator, like I'm able to give script notes and I'm able to give edit notes and working to, you know, at this location, what was written on this page, we can't do for X reason. What about, could we move it to this location? You know, like there's day-to-day creative decisions like that I'll work with the creators with. And then occasionally I am able to jump in and give more creative notes on script and edits. But, you know, I just really feel it out with the person who I'm reporting to.
And then, so on Wilf, on Ferrell Takes the Field, was that kind of your first bigger budget broadcast thing that you did? That was for HBO, right?
Yeah, it was for HBO. Absolutely. It was the biggest at that point in my career. And this was five years ago, I think.
And that was, right, Will Ferrell is going to play baseball in like 10 baseball games or something.
Well, what's funny is that I had done this show, Foul Ball, with Matt.
A baseball prank show.
It was a baseball prank show that we did. Pretty small budget. It aired on CBS.
We also prepped in like a week and a half or something.
Oh my God, it was
something
insane.
Really dumb.
Yeah, yeah. It, like creative and everything. Yeah. We prepped.
Was it with MLB, like Major League Baseball?
No, it was not.
No, they weren't involved at all. Mm.
Yeah, so it was a lot of...
It was a fun, weird little experiment.
It was a real blast, yeah. For sure.
And but, were you a producer on that?
I was a producer on that. And that was College Humor was producing that for CBS Sports. But that had happened... I want to say that happened, and then maybe 6 months later, I got the call to meet for Ferrell Takes the Field. And they, you know, asking me like about what, you know, what have I done? What maybe is like irrelevant. I'm like, well, in the pitch for Ferrell Takes the Field is Will Ferrell is about to play, or he plays in 5 spring training games for 10 teams in one day. And I had this incredibly analogous, I just produced a funny television show with hidden camera elements and docu and like all these things. And it aligned so like perfectly that.
Wait, how did you get this call? Who calls you? Is Eben related to this or no?
No. So I had never worked with Funny or Die. It's kind of a nice convergence of two things. One was Inman Young, who, again, the producer I came up under, he recommended me for it. And then also I had just done that film, Let's Kill Ward's Wife, with Patrick Wilson. And oddly enough, one of the execs at Funny or Die knew Patrick from back in New York. And so I had these two. I had two recommendations. They're both like, oh, yeah, you should definitely hire this guy.
And well, and also at that time, especially like the Funny or Die and the College Humor people, there's a lot of crossover. People were kind of bouncing back and forth. There were camps, certainly, but like if you were working for one, you might as well be working for the other.
Yeah, exactly.
But also I think like an important takeaway here for our listeners is that it's like a lot of times people are like trying to figure out if they should like focus on one thing or one team or one group and like grow together or do a bunch of different things. But so many times you get the job because two totally different people mm-hmm. recommended you.
Yeah, that's how I got hooked up with Ellen as well. Like if you're on two different people's lists, then there you go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Then you have a much, even like when I did that Lifetime movie with Lori Loughlin, we had approached her, you know, through like agents and like the producers and everything, but also Eben, who is all of our friend, happened to like quit filmmaking for like a year to manage like a boy band. Do you remember that?
Oh my God, I completely forgot about that.
A boy band that was put together by like Perez Hilton and whoever put together like
the Backstreet Boys.
No, the British. One Direction. Simon.
What was it? Is it Take Five? No. What was their name?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Anyway, he happened to go to a concert. Like his band was performing at this concert, and Lori Loughlin's kids were huge fans of the band, and so he like brought them backstage, and he's like, "Hey, if you ever need tickets, you know, let's exchange info. Like, let me know. I'll hook you up." And so I told him we just made her an offer, and he's like, "Oh, I'll email her and tell her that I worked with you and that you're a good guy." And so, and I think that's
why she said yes.
She said, or she considered it, because it's so hard to get actors to consider anything, you know?
Yeah.
Even like a kind of mid-level actors, you know, for a TV movie. So anyway, but that's awesome. So you got recommended for this job.
And it got recommended, yeah.
And they didn't care that you hadn't produced, well, I guess you'd produced the CBS thing
at the time, yeah. At the time, though, it was kind of this, a bit of an unknown, too. They're kind of like, it's going to be for HBO, but we don't, because it was thrown together very last minute, a la Foul Ball. It was kind of like, hey, we got to shoot this thing in like 2 weeks. It's kind of this crazy thing that's going to be for HBO.
What stadiums did you guys shoot at?
It was all in Phoenix for spring training. So it was.
But you were bouncing between parks, but you weren't on a plane.
Not between cities. Yeah, we didn't bounce between.
Were you on a helicopter at some point?
We did for traffic and for theatricality.
Oh, I didn't realize it was for theatricality. I thought you guys were bouncing around.
Phoenix traffic is for real.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it is for real. No, we bounced back and forth between five stadiums, and there's like they're technically different cities within Phoenix, right. but it was all in one night. All in one day, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. I don't think it'll be possible to have a crazier shoot day than that. Like everyone that worked on it was like, that was nuts. Like, you know, we worked such an insanely long day, and I got like sick in the middle of the day, and I was like throwing up in the bathroom, and
Were you on the helicopter?
No. The helicopter was just like Will, the pilot, and a cameraman.
Oh, wow.
And we were all in follow vans, and it was...
Because you guys had to get into a stadium, film Will Ferrell in a baseball game, and then get out of the stadium and do a location move.
And Will is like...
Four times.
Both for the theatricality and for actual, you know... He had to change like in the van. He's changing uniforms in the van. We're driving to the next stadium. Yeah, he's wearing the uniform.
Do you have a crew waiting for him, and then you guys are just gonna follow?
We had both. Like, we had a crew with us. We kind of advanced a crew to get us when we landed, and we had a camera in the car with us. And it was, we had three dock cameras. We had a cinematic camera. We had some phantom cameras for some slow. Like we had.
How are you monitoring all this stuff?
Hoping.
Wow. Yeah, really?
We did have monitors.
A director, right?
Yeah, we had a director and kind of an EP showrunner, and they had monitors, and one kind of stuck with the cinematic unit, one was more the docu, so it was planned out. We didn't totally just
we
had 2 full weeks of prep.
It was a crazy plan, but it was a solid one.
It was crazy, but it was sound, and it turned out all right.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So off that, you now have like a bona fide HBO TV credit
with Funny or Die,
and then I, you know, got along great with Funny or Die doing that show. So they had another pilot coming up with Comedy Central that I produced. It's called This Place Sucks. It's a travel show. It's kind of like an anti-travel show with Al Madrigal. And then that rolled into...
That was their first job with them,
That you worked on that show. I know one of the executives on that show, Ian Friedman, because I used to work at Comedy Central. And he and I both have a huge soft spot for Last Call. Do you guys remember that show? It was a Comedy Central travelogue show where Dave Attell would... Basically stay up all night in whatever city he was playing. So he'd start with a little stand-up and then like go crazy places. And that's why I want to go to Anchorage so bad. Because he went during the summer solstice And like, it's daylight all the time. And he's like, oh man, this is crazy. And people are like, fly fishing. It's, you know, 4 a.m. or whatever. Anyway.
I am from Anchorage.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where I'm from.
That's why I was so excited. To bring that show. Yeah. But I forgot that you made that show. Mm-hmm. So funny.
Yep.
So they just handed that to you, even though you'd never done a TV pilot before.
He already made two shows though.
I had done a couple shows, and this was not like a scripted show. It was like a docu-travel kind of a weird show. So it was kind of, I was a good fit for that. And then they had this, back when Go 90 was a thing, they had a handful of shows that they needed to make for them. And so they, after the pilot was done, they're like, do you want to jump on this?
The Burning Man, or like the VidCon in the
desert. We did Tween Fest. We did this show, Our Fascinating Planet, with Dimitri Martin, which I think we were both so funny.
Jess shot that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Jess shot that.
Oren and I were both up for Tween Fest, but then the showrunner decided to direct it. I think that's what it was.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Showrunner Scott
Gardner.
Were we doing the podcast?
Who is a mad genius.
Yeah. He actually isn't the showrunner, but he was an EP.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But yeah, they just kind of rolled into, we had a good thing going, Funny or Die and myself, and they had a lot of work coming up, and they just kept throwing it to me. And the last, so we had produced two shows for Go 90, Tween Fest and Our Fascinating Planet.
Which I guess at this point, it's probably worth mentioning that Go 90 was Verizon's streaming service.
It was worth reminding people. Yeah.
Everyone doesn't know about Go 90?
Well, yeah. If you just started listening to this podcast like 6 months ago and you live in Milwaukee, which...
I heard Go 90 was huge in Milwaukee. Anyway.
Well, I only bring it up because I think we mentioned Milwaukee once, but I feel like five of our listeners emailed and they're like, I'm from Milwaukee. I'm the person you're talking about.
I use it all the time. Oh, it's like my go-to, like, oh, I live in a big real city, but it's not New York or
Sioux
Los
City,
Angeles.
Iowa.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Milwaukee's my go-to for that, yeah.
Anyway, so back to Go 90, which is a Verizon streaming service, which lasted for about 2 years, I think, before it folded.
Give or take. Yeah. They were spending money, though. Mm-hmm. They were spending money.
We were able to make some really cool, real things with,
you got $90 million per show.
But we were getting pitches for the third one, and I had worked with this guy, Tony Ascenda. I love this. This is one of my favorite kind of Hollywood stories because it's Tony and I worked together. His first job in LA I produced. It was that $20,000 big budget branded video that we did for College Humor. And then I got him in with Joe McAleer at Window Seat, and he and I started doing these industrial videos together that are...
Did you do the Mattel Hot Wheels?
Yeah, all these Mattel videos. So we did a bunch of these...
Sizzles, they call
them. Yeah, like they were internal videos for Mattel about their Hot Wheel products.
They're more industrials than internals. I think they would take them to like toy conventions and say check out our new toys to people that buy toys. It could have been that too.
Yeah. So it's like Toys R Us or
It's not KB a TV commercial, but it's like a commercial to, it's like a B2B kind of like to other businesses.
So it still needed to be slick and it was worth it to put resources behind it because...
Some resources.
That we did film it in our
office. And at Joe McAleer's house too. But that was the last project he and I worked on together, is we both, you know, were doing these kind of scrappy projects, and he comes in to pitch this show for Go 90.
So you didn't bring him in for that?
No. I had worked with him. I'm like, oh, we should definitely meet with him.
Did his CBS friend bring him in?
He actually came through Owen Burke, who was at Funny or Die. And I forget how Tony and Owen knew each other, but it was already, CBS was already attached. I forget how that...
Well, he had a friend that worked for CBS.
Yeah.
That they were watching like a Sixers game.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, it was with Alec Botnick, an exec at CBS, and they were watching a Sixers game. And I think he and Dan had come up with the idea that morning, and he pitched it that night, and they were like, oh, this is amazing.
Let's do it.
So he comes in to pitch it for Go 90, and I heard the pitch with a few other people.
This is American Vandal.
I forget if I mentioned that. And we all were like, this is... No offense to Go 90, but like this is a great show,
and this can go somewhere else. They came to pitch this as a Go 90 series.
Yeah. Long story short, a few months later, Netflix has bought it straight to series, and I was still overseeing some of the Go 90 shows with Funny or Die, but basically they were gracious enough to, you know, I'd work with Tony and been working with them for so long that they offered me to jump on and produce that. So that was...
But I think it's worth pointing out, though. So you have a track record with Funny or Die, right? You have a track record making documentary, real documentaries, right? Even though they're zany, right? But they're off the cuff. You have a working relationship with the show creator.
With Tony.
Yeah. And I had one other point. It was a relatively low budget compared to the rest of Netflix's slate, right?
Like,
right.
But it's still like $6 million or something.
Right? Yeah, millions and millions of dollars, but not Stranger Things millions.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think we but look
six
back
million
now,
for like a, I mean, it depends if you consider it a docu-series or not, but if you do, then that's a lot of money for a docu-series.
Yeah, right? But it's also a scripted series that has to follow all the you know, union rules and scripted television rules. That was actually the one thing that we ran into a lot was you want to treat it like a doc, but you also have all the guilds that you have to adhere to all their rules. You couldn't just do it like a doc, you know?
Well, right. When Tony was on the podcast, he said like that you guys were shooting somewhere and there was a fireplace with a light switch or something that you like, I might be remembering this incorrectly, but he wanted to turn it on. So there's a fire in the background. They're like, no, we don't have permits to have fires on in the shot and like all this stuff, like just the simplest thing that if you were just shooting it in any other way, it would be so easy.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, it's going to be like $6,000 to get all the permits and all that stuff for that.
Let me recommend, if you shoot in Russia, there's just a little man with a propane tank.
He'll light anyone on fire for you.
For real, I did some cat commercials in Russia in the beginning of 2019. And I was like, well, how does the fireplace work? After asking if there was a FSO, a fire safety officer, and they were like, we don't know what you're talking about. And there was just
like, he just died of starvation, just a man
hidden in the chimney basically with a propane tank that he would turn on, and then he'd flamethrow all of the fireplace, and then when I'd call cut, he'd turn it off, and they were like, don't roll for too long
because he's in the chimney.
Wait, he wasn't
in the chimney, but he's like tucked around the corner.
Oh, that's so funny.
That was the plan. That's what we did. And there's like cats running around.
That
and stuff.
Tracks for the Russian cat commercial.
Anyway, I digress.
So before this, you had done like a big union, like a Yahtzee and SAG and all that
stuff. I had worked with all the unions before, but this was my first, I think, full union shoot. So that means SAG for the actors, WGA for the writers, DGA for the directors, IATSE for the crew, and Teamsters for the drivers. And
do you have to be a WGA or DGA show for Netflix? Is that a requirement?
For CBS, yeah, because they're signatory. So CBS as a studio, and so CBS produced American Vandal, even though it aired on Netflix, it ran through the studio. But yeah, they have an agreement that, you know, everything they do needs to be full union. So.
And so are you PGA or DGA at this point?
Nope.
Today are you?
Mm-mm. No.
You're not PGA?
How does
you look offended?
Well, you're a producer on Dead to Me. That's your credit.
Well,
you're a producer
Producers
on.
Guild is not actually like a labor union or not. It's just an organization, really. There's no sort of rights that you get because of it.
You get great screeners.
You get great
screeners. Do you get health insurance? Is it like DGA?
You can through it get, I think, access to, if you don't get health insurance through a different guild, which I do, they can help you, but no, it's not like the other guilds.
But what about, you know, our friend Corey Knopf, he's DGA because he UPM'd like one show.
I've never UPM'd, yeah. I've just produced.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So producers are not DGA.
No, producers do not have any.
Including line producers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is a UPM not kind of like a line producer?
It is, yeah. Well, a UPM often is the line producer too. There's a lot of overlap between, you know, I can't UPM because that's a DGA position, but oftentimes the line producer will be the UPM and they'll satisfy both functions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's unit production manager, right? Which is pretty much the person that is producing, like physical, in charge of physical production.
Yeah, in charge
production.
Of basically the top dog of physical production.
Right.
But he or she and I will work basically together as a unit when we're... Mm-hmm. producing and we become, you know, I'll usually, if I haven't worked with them before, we'll kind of split tasks and make sure that, okay, you know, you're going to handle all vendor deals and all crew things and I'm going to handle X, you know.
Right. And in order to satiate the union requirements, you basically just have to have a person doing
that. Yeah, you
work,
have to have
basically.
That union position.
And also probably, I imagine, a handful of other, you know, coordinator type people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, my staff on a show like American Vandal, on in the production office was two PAs, a coordinator, and a UPM. Whereas on Dead to Me, it's myself, a UPM, a production supervisor, production coordinator, an assistant production coordinator, production secretary, and two PAs. Yeah, so it's a lot. It's a bit
an indie film team. It's of heads, basically.
Yeah, like you exactly. Could, yeah, it's necessary. Once you scale up to that size, there's just again, there's so much. You know, when you have 150 crew members every single day. Mm-hmm. There's just a certain infrastructure that's required.
With union fringes and specific mandates and then the reporting on all of that as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And so is there a point at all when you're like doing American Vandal? Actually, I don't know if you remember, but I came to Funny or Die. Like I had a meeting there with someone and I saw you there and I was like, hey, what are you doing here? And you're like, oh, well, I'm doing this show with Tony Ascenda. I was like, who are you doing it for? And you're like, Netflix. And I was like, what on earth are you talking about? And I saw you guys, like you went into a room and it was like a writer's room. And you had, I think, like the guy that was like the kind of the showrunner. Yeah. Like, were you ever nervous? Like, now I'm doing this big TV show.
And not really, because it was still so analogous to what I've been doing before. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just kind of like I heard this once before. It's really just kind of move the decimal place. The work really is the same. It's just the numbers are a bit bigger and, you know, everything scales up slightly, but it's really the same work.
But you're like in the writer's room and stuff, right?
On American Vandal. No, I wasn't in the room. No. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. I
kind of popped in and
I
out.
Pop in and out. Yeah.
You just drop like a zinger or two.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then, I'll, you know,
I guess at some
that
point.
That one's for free boys.
I mean, like when you talk about Tween Fest or when you talk about Unscripted Travel Show or something with Will Ferrell, like there's kind of these safety things. And like, you know that Will Ferrell playing baseball at five different games, it can only be so bad, right?
Yeah.
Like, but once you're working now with millions of dollars and you want it to be like a broadcast quality, like TV show that, you know, gets mm-hmm. another season. I don't know. I guess it seems like.
Expectations
are higher.
Yeah, when we were making Vandal, like especially once we got into the edit, and you know that was a show where I was there throughout all of posts, and I'm watching cuts, and the guys, you know, would pull me in and ask thoughts on things. Yeah, I was sitting in all the casting sessions, but as we started churning out cuts, I think all of us were like, man, we think this is really good, mm-hmm. but we have no idea. When you're so right. close to a project, you just have
you
no
think
idea.
It's great.
Yeah, you're like, I think what we're making is good, but I have no idea if anyone else will think that way. So I didn't, for me, of course, someone like Tony or Dan who created the show, and this is their, you know, first huge break, you know, being creators of a Netflix show, I would imagine they felt a lot more pressure than I did as kind of the facilitator. But no, you know, I learned really early on to not stress. I used to stress a lot when I was producing. I used to worry about everything.
Joe can't help but glance at me right now.
I used to micromanage a bit, sure. and I would worry about every little facet. Anything that I could control, I would like worry about it, and I'd lose sleep, and I would try to do everything. And then, you know, as I kind of settled into producing, and that probably is a byproduct of me coming up the ranks pretty quickly, because I think American Vandal, this was 2016, so this was 7 years into my career in LA, which is pretty quick. But I learned early that I just like, it's not worth it. I just can't, the quality of life when you micromanage and stress and all these things, I was just like, I can't do this. So I'm going to, the way I see I'm doing my best work, the way that I feel like I'm doing my best work is when I'm just not needed. Mm-hmm. If I've done my job, I could be anywhere doing sure. nothing in the show, you know? So I just, you have to just trust the people you hire, that they're doing their work and they're managing their teams. And yeah, that's, I feel like I would have quit a long time ago if I had continued to stress as much as I did when I was like first starting to produce.
Sure.
Okay. So American Vandal comes out and you win a Peabody Award.
Mm-hmm.
How much extra money do you make when that happens?
So much money. We all got so rich. No, I didn't make any more money.
Didn't make any more
money. No more money.
You got a second season though.
Got a second season. Yeah.
And you did that. You produced the second season mm-hmm. too.
Yep. So I did season one of Vandal. And then once that wrapped, I did season one of No Activity, which was it's such an amazing show. I'm going to plug that show real quick because I feel like not enough people see it or know about it.
I did see a billboard the other day.
Yeah,
for
they
season
do.
Two.
They do
a
good job with the billboard. Season three.
Right now? Oh,
yeah,
pardon me.
It's out right now. Yeah.
Wow.
Season one, we had Bob Odenkirk and Will Ferrell and J.K. Simmons and Jesse Plemons and all these amazing folks on top of our amazing regulars, Patrick Bramall and Tim Meadows and Amy Sedaris and just like powerhouse comedy people.
And who got, how'd you
that's
get that?
CBS also. That's also Funny or Die in CBS.
Oh, okay.
So I rolled Vandal straight into No Activity, straight back into season two of Vandal, which we shot in Portland, straight into season two of No Activity, which we shot here, straight into Dead to Me season one.
Okay, so how'd you get Dead to Me?
Hold on, actually, before that, I want to go back to the Peabody thing, because you were joking about how it didn't make you, you didn't get it. There's no prize money. Did your quote go up? Did the
No. For me, again, it's like I firmly believe that what I do is more than a, you know, a line producer. I was able to get a co-EP credit on that show, and I do think I contribute a lot more. But I'm not a writer on the show, and I'm essentially, you know, I serve a line producing function, and a Peabody doesn't mean that much, I think, to it as a non-writer. I think
it kind of doesn't matter if the show is good.
It's, exactly.
Did it run smoothly?
Yeah. Exactly.
Right, yeah, but fair. Do you think, I guess, do you think about the marketing of it all? Like, do you think like, hey, I produced this Peabody award-winning show. I produced this show with all these stars. I produce, like, when you go to the next person, whether...
I mean, undoubtedly that means that you're bona fide.
Yeah, right? Well, yeah. I think the Peabody, more than anything for me, like, it was so proud and shocked, you know, and really proud of our writers and Tony and Dan and our showrunner Dan Lagana, because it really fell on them. They are the reason the show is as good as it was. I helped them realize that vision, but they, you know, they are the brains and the, we all put in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. It was, you know, not an easy show, but I was really proud of them, you know, like, and I'll, of course I'll, I would love to take the award and say, yes, I am also a Peabody award winning producer.
Well, you are technically.
No, I am. Yeah. I've got a statue. Yeah. I've got a little.
Yeah. See, there you go.
But don't you think that's part of what this whole thing is about? Is like, I mean, you are part, like, it's not like you're exaggerating or anything. Like, you are, you know, a producer on the show. You were like one of Tony's champions from like day one, you know, like, it seems like totally legitimate to say, yeah, I got a Peabody for the show I produced.
100% it is.
If you were a grip or an electrician or did makeup or something, like, I think you could still say, like, I'm doing this. And I guess what I was going to ask next is, in the last, like, few years, have you worked on anything that you didn't think that you weren't crazy about?
I've been so insanely lucky that I have really cared about the projects I've been doing the last 3 or 4 years. I feel like I haven't ever had to phone it in. Every one of them has been really challenging, and for very different reasons, I've enjoyed them. I think, you know, the personal relationship with Tony on Vandal was an instant in, but there's so many things that were challenging and fun and amazing about that shoot. On No Activity, the creators are so tack sharp and fun and good people to be around. And like, it's such a funny show, and I'm really proud of different
real
things.
Sounds real challenging to be around creative, funny people.
And then Dead to Me, I mean...
Yeah, Dead to Me also seems like a pretty big step up. I know it's a Netflix show, but it's like Christina Applegate and, you know...
It was
a high-profile
Dead to Me was show.
And
a big...
pure scripted, right?
Yeah, entirely scripted.
There's no baseball or hidden cameras.
No baseball, not yet. Very, very traditional kind of, you know, cinematic half-hour comedy, dramedy.
Thriller dramedy.
But that came through CBS. So I'd been working, doing these shows for CBS, Vandal, and No Activity for a couple of years. And they... basically, as soon as I wrapped up season two of No Activity, they were like, I know it's kind of last minute, but we have the show starting. Do you want to meet with a showrunner? And she and I, Liz Feldman, we met. And I don't know if you guys have seen the show, but I mean, the pilot, I read the pilot one before I met with her, and I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is really incredible. And when I heard the cast, it was kind of, you know, undeniable that this would be a pretty amazing project. So I got, you know...
And you had all that before you met with Liz Feldman.
I got the pilot as I was... Well, yeah, like, right before I met with her.
Which her... Like, the story of how she pitched that show is pretty awesome, too.
Yeah, and she's... Yeah, she's got a...
Like, it was kind of like on a whim, right?
Yeah, the genesis of that's... Well, it's... I won't try to tell because I don't know it entirely. But yeah, I mean, she's... how that show came to her is very interesting.
But I guess when I had heard an interview with her that... she'd pitched all these shows and everyone's like, yeah, maybe we're kind of interested. Let's keep talking about it. And then like last second, she's like, also this weird thing happened to me. And like, I thought that might make a good show. And they're like, done, sold, make it.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
Real quick, actually, just to clarify for listeners at home, can you clarify the difference between when you say you have a deal with CBS versus the channel CBS at home on their clickers?
Yeah, so CBS...
Because they're like, oh, mm-hmm. you're making a CBS show that's on Netflix.
Yes, yeah. So CBS as a studio... So there's two CBSs. There's the network where you watch all of the things, and then there's the studio, which it gets a little convoluted, and it took me a while to firmly understand the studio system, but there's many studios across town, such as CBS, such as Warner Brothers, you know...
Fox, ABC.
That... They produce shows to air on their network, but they also produce shows to sell to other networks. So it's they are separate entities. So CBS Network isn't necessarily, you know, CBS Studios is not beholden to air stuff on their network. They operate kind of like a very big production company where they, you know, acquire IP and develop scripts and work with other studios and other networks.
Not to mention that CBS is also owned by Viacom, that also owns MTV and VH1 and all these other networks.
Yeah, look, there's like two media companies. I guess three.
Yeah, it's super confusing.
Yeah.
But so I guess my big question now is, so you've produced, like Matt said, you produced this baseball show, you produced this HBO documentary, you've produced this kind of semi-scripted, like docu-style show for Netflix, and I've produce this big award-winning comedy, like celebrity-driven comedy for Netflix about murder, I guess. Do you think you're in a position where you could find a new script or a new director or a new project or a new actor and bring them into CBS or HBO or Funny or Die or someplace and say, hey, I have a project, and be like more like an EP creator producer than a line producer.
Yeah, I think that's where I want my career to go. As much as I love what line producing has afforded me and the places it's got me and the people I've been able to work with, but man, it's stressful.
Sure.
It's a lot of numbers and accounting.
A lot of spreadsheets.
And a lot of hours spent doing things that, you know, you have to do to produce a show well, but it might not be the most scintillating thing. So yeah, no, I think, yes, I am able to do things like that. Will it help me in a room? No. I don't, you know, will my resume...
You don't think so? But you don't think like running a trailer for Matt's, you know, teen drama, like murder comedy, and saying from the producer of Dead to Me, like you don't think that counts for anything?
Not to mention the
literal fact that you know how to make that show.
I think that the challenge... And forgive me if I'm putting words in your mouth, Joe, but like, I think that people compartmentalize the way what people do, right? And so your position, even though you have a lot of creative input, traditionally is not that.
Exactly.
Right? So it's kind of like, well, you know, would I take a story pitch from my mechanic? If it was fucking awesome, yeah. But like,
no,
there is a little bit of that, right?
No, I mean, it might be
The mechanic, I think, is like a gross exaggeration, but I think maybe maybe it's more akin to like, I'm the DP of Mad Men and I've shot, you know, 100 episodes. I directed 3 of them and now I'm pitching a new show to someone. Like,
well, but directing is different, right? Like if you were the DP of Mad Men, but you never directed and then you pitched a show, you'd be closer to Joe's position.
Yeah,
right?
I think, but I guess maybe
this is like a mini intervention or something, but like, I feel like maybe you have a producer credit. It doesn't say line producer on IMDb.
Yeah. I think it will help me get in a room for sure. If it's a production company or studio or whomever that maybe doesn't know me, will it get me a meeting? I think absolutely. I think, will it help the show sell? I think that just depends on the, I think.
But how many times have we heard like, oh, new writer, amazing writer, wrote this great pilot. They're trying to pitch it. And no one is going to buy it from them until you put them with an established showrunner, established producer, established company, established studio. I'm wondering, do you count as that established producer?
I don't think so. I wish I did. I think maybe...
So do Oren and I.
Yeah.
I'm selling myself slightly, but I really don't think that... Yeah, the function that I've served in these merits. Oh, you know, like, yeah, have I proved that I can get the job done and make a good show on budget and on time and deliver high quality? Yeah. Does that mean I can do that with a script? And you know what I mean? Like,
Like Chuck Lorre is the what what they're describing. Like if Chuck's like, yeah, I'm going to EP this movie or this TV show, then we can hire Joe, you know?
Right, but Joe has that. He can say like, oh, we'll call Jessica Elbaum or we'll call Dan Fogarty, what's his name?
I don't know.
The showrunner of American Vandal.
Oh, Dan Lagana.
Or we can call the showrunner of No Activity. Like, but have this network now.
Yeah.
I think more often than not, though, that is where you'd start. You know, you'd start with the people that can help shepherd from an earlier phase, and then you'd bring me on. Yeah, I think the role that I've been serving the last, 5 years has been that. It's like, oh, you've got this thing and it's ready to go. Great, bring me on and I'll help you make that happen.
Sure. Could you call those guys and take them a project? Yes.
Absolutely.
But like they would still be the person to really get it going. You wouldn't go to all of the executives that you know at all the networks you've worked at.
Right? No, I mean, I could, but I think at this particular point in my career, it wouldn't be as advantageous. Yeah. Do I want that to change? Yeah, I think like that's something that I'm working towards, and that in the night, hopefully, when I'm on episode 400 of the show, I can say, you know what? Yeah, I was able to do this, and now I'm the guy.
Yeah,
and this is great.
Which is like, I think it's just like the point is that it's all baby steps, right? And mm-hmm. Joe, you've been so good at illustrating, putting yourself out there, doing the work, but then also like being there to at the right place and right time.
Yeah,
right? Like you can see a very clear linear line.
It was very incremental.
Yeah,
it was very, you know, I took each little step, and I probably took it faster than maybe, you know, others did for various reasons. But I think I don't like to think of it as luck because of how much hard work and persistence and knowledge it is. But it's luck. You know, I got a lot of. Mm-hmm. There's so much just happenstance and things that are so out of my control. Why I got the call for this, and I think that I set myself up to, you know, again, it was super incremental.
To me, luck is like the opportunity, but you have to be there to follow up.
Exactly.
You know, so like is it lucky that someone was looking for someone with your skill set at the time? Yes, but if you hadn't done a good job doing all the things that led up to this, then you wouldn't have gotten the gig.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and also you have a track record of successful shows. Like, I feel like if I went to my manager and I said, hey, I have this project, here's a script, here's like a deck, here's proof of concept, and I have the producer from Dead to Me that is down, is really excited to work on this, he would be more excited than if I didn't say
it. Yeah, you have to find the shiny thing though, right?
I think to your point, does it help a little bit? Yeah. It would it inevitably get a show greenlit? Probably not. But does it help? Sure. Yeah. I think it does help.
Okay.
You're
good.
Right.
Because I'm sending you some scripts, and all our listeners are going to email you.
Yeah. Yeah.
JoeHardesty@hotmail.com.
Having access and a good track record for sure is going to help you. There's still, I guess what I'm saying is that even though Joe is super successful in making all these great things, that there are also just, there's always additional incremental steps, and you know what they are. And because you've done such a good job working with all these other showrunners who could get a show greenlit, that's no disrespect, right? Like, that's great. They'll be happy to hear what you have to say. But, like, it's just, you know, just because you're a big-time producer doesn't mean that it's, like, you're done and ready to go. Like,
right.
Right, that's all.
It's not easy, but
you're
it's easier.
You're both right.
Yeah.
You guys are both right.
And you're great.
Thank you.
There we go.
So my last question is, so you've worked with, of the newer, younger filmmakers you've worked with, like, Tony Ascenda. I don't know if Liz Feldman had done a ton of stuff before Dead to Me or not, but what are some things that you see that they had in common? Like some advice you could give our listeners that are either directors or writers or like aspiring producers. Like what are the things that you've seen that make people get excited about a project?
To me, what stuck out the most, and I think Liz had been around, she'd been doing this for quite some time. She's been writing on kind of big shows and for many years. So I wouldn't put her, you know, she's been doing
more
it for
established.
A bit. Yeah, she's more established. But to me, what I think what was a great lesson to take away going back to American Vandal was the Tony and Dan. I hope Tony listens to this and hears how nicely we talk about him.
I think Tony does listen.
Hey, Tony.
If he doesn't, his dad listens.
Drop us an email.
So, let's grab dinner sometime soon. I'll text you. No, I think the lesson that, you know, Tony and Dan were given this incredible opportunity, and they worked so insanely hard for so long. Once we started shooting to when we finished post, I mean, I don't think they had a weekend for months on end. They were working, they were doing VO on Sundays. They were in the bay staggering our editor. Like, they realized what they had and they worked their ass off. And I think, like, that work ethic, and, you know, I did too, to a certain extent, but they, I think when an opportunity arises and you have a chance to prove yourself, like, you know,
prove it.
I love a good weekend when I'm stressed and I need, you know, like, you know what, I'm not going to check my email till 2 PM today, but you can't always do that. And I know, like, when you have an opportunity, no, you got to be like tireless. Like, it was unfathomable what season one of Vandal, like how much they worked. And season two, also they worked really hard, but season one was just like months on end. They'd come in on Monday and it just looked so fried because they'd been working all weekend. And I was just like, man, you guys, you know, hopefully the show turns out and does a thing and pays off. But like their work ethic was inspiring. And I think that's something that anyone can get excited about. And, you know, it'll make you the people around you work hard as well.
Okay, so your advice is sell a show to Netflix.
Yeah, just and script a series. Straight to series.
Show up when there's an opportunity.
Yeah, I'm saying,
because
yeah.
Tony is one example of that, but Joe, you are the other example of that, right? And that starts with a $20,000 College Humor branded video all the way up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Look at that.
Matt gets it. Yeah, or, I don't know about him.
awesome. Well, thanks, man. Thanks for coming. Thanks
Can I please talk about Starbucks?
Yeah. Yes. Hold on. We're going to move into unpaid endorsements.
Unpaid endorsements. Joe, tell us why you think that going to Starbucks Reserve is such a good idea.
Okay.
Literally one of the very best coffee neighborhoods, maybe in the country, in the city.
So I forget. So you don't like Starbucks.
I don't have a problem with Starbucks, but if you're talking about the Starbucks Reserve on Hillhurst, then we're talking, you know, if you are okay with corporations, you've got Blue Bottle, you know, half a block away. You've got Maru, the best cup in town. You've got Go Get 'em Tiger. You've got Brew. You've got H Coffee House. I live in this neighborhood. There's so many great, genuinely great
House of Pies. Gibbs Cop makes coffee too.
That's true.
Don't get me wrong. I love a good Maru iced Americano. I love a good Blue Bottle cold brew when the occasion arises. What I find though is Starbucks is so polarizing. The reason I'm giving it my endorsement is because I feel like, you
people
know, you work with
it.
People and people hate it. They're like, ugh. When I say, hey, why don't we run to Starbucks? They're like, ugh. You know, they give that guttural. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You can get
that. By the way, that kind of indicates like what level of people you're working with.
Sure. How much?
Like, how rich do you have to be to be like disgusted by Starbucks?
Oh my God. I only spend $6 or more on my coffee is what you're saying.
For 10 months out of the year, an iced coffee is all I need. Starbucks iced coffee, unsweetened.
$2.
All I need.
Yeah, sure.
And then for 2 months out of the year, all I even want is the Christmas blend. It's all I want. From Thanksgiving till like right now.
All right, you
Christmas
won me
blend.
Over.
Yeah. And then the Maru rest of the
doesn't
year.
Have a Christmas blend.
No, the Christmas blend is so good. My wife bought me some beans. I was making Christmas blend pour overs at home for Christmas. Ugh, it was so good.
That was a real curveball for me. Yeah. All right, well, look,
so that's why you're endorsing that. You're endorsing the Christmas blend.
I'm endorsing the Christmas blend, and I do think that their iced coffee is second to none.
And also, I mean, they are literally a third of the price of any other coffee shop. And if you drink coffee twice a day, like...
Yeah, that's up. Yeah.
My wife makes fun of me a lot for this, but I also think that when you find a new Starbucks, to me, it feels like I'm on vacation. Like, oh, look at that Starbucks. I'm going to go in there. Wow, look at this decor. I feel like...
Not the one in the Vons, though. That one's kind
of no. But I feel like I can, any day of the week, I can go on vacation and just find a Starbucks that I've never been to before.
Are you a member? A gold member? Gold card holder?
Oh, come on, Warren.
I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, but it's been a while, so I'll just remind people, if you are a member, you get free refills on your coffee.
But at this, it has to be the same location.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They kind of fudge that, though. You can get away with things.
They'll help you out. Well, that is wonderful. I've got two endorsements, Joe.
Only one. I'm just kidding. I'm just giving.
Or endorsed 15 things last episode. So I'm going to go lowbrow and highbrow. Lowbrow, do you guys know the show The Circle?
No.
It is a Netflix reality show that's airing weekly right now. I think they're doing it in batches of like 3 episodes a week. But it's basically if you take Big Brother plus like Tinder or like just social media and combine them together. So it's all these people who are sequestered in their own little apartments, but they're not allowed to talk to each other except for via social media. So they're just like dictating text messages to one another through a big TV that's like basically the app that they use called The Circle. And then they vote each other out each week, and it is...
And what's the drama?
The drama is just who's going to get voted out. Like,
are there challenges?
It's purely a popularity contest. There are challenges, but for the most part, it really just boils down to who likes who best, and which is meant to like, you know, reflect social media in general. And it is easily the stupidest show I've ever watched. It is so aggressively dumb, and I've watched every episode.
It sounds interesting.
I'll check it out.
It's really dumb.
I probably won't watch it, but it sounds interesting.
It's on Netflix, you said?
It's on Netflix, and it's called The Circle. And then my flip side is, if you need to just like mellow out or like write or something like that, and I love like finding good orchestral music to write to, The Marriage Story score is on Spotify, and it's great. It's Randy Newman, so it's got like a little levity to it, but it's still lush and rich and like a full big movie, like a classic movie score. It's not like John Williams style, but it's got plenty of girth to it and like is a real treat to write to.
So, can I listen to it before I've seen the movie?
Without a doubt. Yeah, great. Without a doubt. Though,
no spoilers?
No spoilers. they it'd be great. Like, remember the soundtracks used to have like little excerpts from the movie in between? They don't do that.
No.
That movie's pretty great too.
Yeah, I gotta see it.
I'll throw in a lowbrow endorsement. Have you guys seen My 600-Pound Life on Hulu?
Nope.
No.
Check it out.
It's just about a person who's 600 pounds and living life.
Every episode is about a different person that's 600 pounds.
Oh.
How many episodes have you watched?
Like 5.
They're not really 600 pounds though. That's just kind of...
No,
they're just
like
obese.
590. Yeah. I haven't seen anyone over 600, but like 594 I think was the first.
How would they not have anyone actually over 600 pounds in the first few episodes?
Hey, listen, when you're north of 400, I think, look.
But then you got to change the show name.
They might have been 600, but by the time they got to the doctor's office and weighed themselves, they dipped a few pounds under.
Oh, good.
But it's crazy. It's like, you know, you need to fire the fire department to get you out of your house to go see the doctor. Anyway, it's kind of crazy. But my other endorsement is, and this is something based on something that happened to me today, is I got like these notes from a producer on an edit, and he just opened the email with like, hey, here are my notes. This time code, you know, this isn't working. This time code.
No build, break, build.
No summary, no overall reactions. No like, hey, good first cut, you know, like.
No macro notes.
No, nothing big. And it's like, it's kind of been bothering me all day. I've been like, everything I've done since he sent me those notes. I'm like, and I saw him this morning for a brief second. I was like, hey, are you going to send me the notes? And he's like, yeah, I'll try to get them to you by 10. And I was like, okay. I thought he would at least be like, yeah, great. Yeah.
So
interesting.
Good. I'm really excited.
Lots of thoughts.
I got a couple things. Yeah.
See,
yeah.
I thought you were going the other way. I thought you were going to be like, it was so fresh to just get the notes. That's
no,
all I
like
want.
I love specific notes, but I prefer, it's funny because I give like such specific notes. I'll be like, 1 second, we hear a noise at this point, whatever. But like, I always start off with like, hey, great. You know, I think like some restructure, even if it's bad
we're
notes.
We're all still sensitive artists and it's easy to forget that.
So whenever you send someone notes on their cut, like start off with like, what you liked, and then very gently say some things that you think they might want to consider as like restructuring or some things that didn't work for you or bumped you, and then go into specific things. And at the end, say like, you know, excited to see the next one. Love to get on the phone, see what resonates with you, like what notes you want to discuss, you know. But these notes were just like, this part doesn't work. This actor is not doing well.
See, I kind of think that's like not being the director or artiste behind it. Like it's kind of super refreshing because I feel like it's like a joke anytime you're ever on a notes call. It's like, oh, we love this so much and this is so good and blah, blah, blah. A few notes. You know, it's like it's all, there's always a build up, whether it's good or it's shit. There's always the same build.
But I don't need the, we love this so much. I just need like, hey, I'm acknowledging that you just spent many hours working on this thing and thank you for doing that. You know, and everyone knows that if the note you get on, they get on their short film is like, oh, it looks beautiful. It means it sucks. Right. Like, like that's like kind of notes 101, but you still have to start with like, this is what I'm enjoying and this is what I'm not enjoying, you know?
Yeah,
and just starting straight into like, this is what sucks, but also giving like, when you're like, oh, the sound effect here, the dog, one of the notes he gave us was like, the dog's barks were like too angry. And this is an audio thing, audio only thing. It's like, can you find like a friendlier dog? Like these dog, and I don't even know if like the scene is working, you know, like sure. That if the segment is working, the story is working. So just going into those such minute notes on a first cut, I don't know.
I think on a practical level, there's the like, oh, we loved it. That doesn't mean anything, right? Yeah. But there is a level of like, if you're sincere and like, here are the things that are working, that helps off V-wings, but also keeps us from throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? Like, no, preserve these things because they were worth it. They were good. Here are the things to fix.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. No, I agree with that. And for the record, I always, you know, you do. Sure. You, it's just common, you know, kind of decency. Say, hey, great work. This part of it, what you did is awesome. Here's some thoughts, you know.
Don't,
but at the same time, I do find bullshit. It kind of refreshing to be like, here you go. Nothing but notes.
Yeah, just throw the good stuff in there. Don't ruin this part. Don't ruin that part.
If you're you're going to jump into just specific time code notes and be like, I like this. This worked well for me. This doesn't work well. You know, this. Mm-hmm.
And also, so then you have contrast, you know, like then, you know, like, okay, well then this thing feels better than the other thing that they're noting, you know?
Yeah. And this, by the way, is not someone I've worked with 100 times before. This is like our first project together too. So it's like, I get the shorthand with someone. So my endorsement, whether you guys agree with me or not, is when you are responding, giving notes on something creative, try to give an overall impression at first, try to find something you like, and try to kind of introduce the bulk of your things. I think some restructuring might help, and then go into the specifics, and then try to end it with, again, like re-summarize like kind of what's working for you and say that you're excited to see how it's going to progress.
I wholeheartedly agree. I think the perfect note, if it's an email, is the thank you for whatever you're liking about it. Like, this is great. Macro notes, page notes, or time code notes, including in that is the love this joke. Mm-hmm. This is killer. This is work. You know, like, I think that is important. And then you have kind of final summary. Thank you. It's the
wham bam.
It might be boilerplate, but it's
there's a reason.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, Joe, this has been great. How can our listeners keep track of all the cool things that you are doing? Do you tweet? Do you Instagram?
Just
subscribe to
A Facebook. I don't use it. I have an Instagram. I rarely use it. Maybe I'll start Instagramming more.
On Venmo?
I'm on Venmo. You can track my transactions. No, I don't do too much social stuff. And unfortunately my IMDb only changes like once or twice a year because the projects I work on are like seven months long.
Well,
I'll text you and you can do a daily update.
Just let everyone know.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to get Joe bought coffee today for the crew.
Yeah. Starbucks Christmas blend.
It's the iced coffee tastes like old Starbucks Christmas blend. Well, listen, if you want to learn more about Joe or the things that we talked about or follow the rest of this show, you can follow us at Just Shoot It Pod across all social media. You can go to justshootitpod.com to check out other episodes.
And you can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 1-6262-SHOOT-1.
That's right.
Oh, wow.
You can follow me at Mr. Matt Emma.
And I'm on Instagram, where I've been posting a lot of film-related stuff because of some annoying listeners that complained about too many family photos.
Or some positive reinforcement also. I've gotten a lot of good feedback about those posts.
Oh, thanks. I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram.
This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams, and you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Additional ad music by MusicBed.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.